This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here again to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and of course some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line now for you at 1-800-462-7413. And as always, along with your call, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, a new system, which is great, that may be able to tell you when to take your pills. What do you think about that?
Isn't that a wife?
I better not bring that particular statement home. Yes, it may be a wife or a spouse. And we're also going to talk about weight loss surgery. It's not just for vanity. It may actually make a difference because it may remodel your heart.
Mm-hmm. And a recipe?
Beer steamed salmon. It's got great ingredients. It's got beer. It's got steam. And guess what? It's got salmon.
So we don't even have to do it. Everybody knows the ingredients.
It really is a good recipe. It's a simple recipe. I like simple recipes that are tasty. Delicious salmon has omega-3 fatty acids, which, you know, are great for the heart. You will love this recipe because it is dynamite.
We have a medical myth buster, too. Now, Zorba, let's get to the phones. I'm happy to welcome a listener now in Jacksonville, Florida. Jacksonville, hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
All right, Tom and Zorba, I've got ringing in the ears, tinnitus, and I've had it for over 15 years. Started off when I was in the military, but the doctors, audiologists told me back then that it was probably an accumulation of ear infections that I had growing up in Florida, swimmer's ear, swimming in dirty water and pond water and such as that. And I'm wondering, the ringing is getting progressively worse. What can I do? Hearing aids, surgeries, of the like.
I want to go back a bit to the military stuff. What did you do in the military? Were you around a lot of loud noises?
No, I was an air traffic controller, you know, pretty much hidden from the noise in the tower or radar facility.
Uh-huh. What about during basic training? Were you around booms? The reason is loud sounds tend to destroy the cochlear cells, and these are hair cells within the cochlea, which is essentially where we actually appreciate the sounds of hearing. And ear infections, although they definitely can cause tinnitus, there's no doubt about it. Swimming in dirty water doesn't usually cause tinnitus. You've got to have recurrent ear infections where you need an antibiotic, and that's a middle ear infection. It's on the other side of the eardrum. Were you on antibiotics a lot as a kid? Did you have a lot of infections?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had recurrent eardrum or ear infections just because of being in the heat all the time and swimming all the time.
Okay, so you did that. And once again, no loud noises. You weren't around any loud factory noises or anything like that when you were younger.
You know, growing up in the 80s, I'm in my 40s now, so uh-huh. The hair band days and loud music was prevalent in my era. So not to say that I haven't been around loud music, I have.
Uh-huh. So because that kind of can add to it. Now, what about your regular hearing? Can you hear people okay, or are you having trouble with your hearing?
The right ear is about 60% loss in the high and low ranges.
Okay.
The very high-pitched noises and the very low, mm-hmm. I cannot hear. And then in the middle, it's kind of muddled. The left ear is okay.
Left ear is okay.
But it's getting to the point to where it's becoming a hassle, and I've got a friend that's got two in-the-canal eardrums, and I've been talking to him, and I'm, you know, almost to the point to where I probably want to consider that.
Right. And frankly, you will do better with hearing aids. So a couple of things first about tinnitus. Tinnitus is basically the response of the auditory system to damage, and it's either damage from noise, damage from infection, or damage from both. And that's usually what the case is. And so for people to adjust to it when they're trying to go to sleep at night, it's often people listen to a radio, or they'll listen to white noise, or they'll listen to the sound of an ocean. And the idea is to sort of distract the brain so we don't pay attention to the ringing. And when people go to sleep, that's usually when it bothers them the most. And during the daytime, they often can adjust unless they're in an environment where they can't hear well, because it's often associated with decreased hearing.
Well, now, he mentioned something in the eardrums.
Well, he's talking about hearing aids that are in the canal, Right, good hearing aids.
Yeah. Oh, hearing aids.
He's talking
about hearing aids isn't going to stop tinnitus. Yeah.
Well, actually it does, because what happens is, especially during the daytime, not at nighttime, you can hear better. And when you can hear better, you don't pay attention to the tinnitus. So if you find that you have a hearing problem, the reason why people don't like hearing aids, well, there are a bunch of reasons. First of all, they're much more expensive than glasses. Yeah. Good hearing aids cost a ton of money. They cost a lot.
It's going down. The cost is going down.
The cost is going down, and it's worthwhile.
As a hearing aid wearer. Uh-huh. The cost is, it used to be maybe $3,000 for two of them, mm-hmm. two good ones. Yeah. Now it's down to about two.
Yeah. And the in-the-canal hearing aids, of course, are much more expensive because they're, the ones that are really tiny. But the thing about hearing aids is that they really work. Even though they're not sexy looking, they really, really make a difference.
They're not that bad looking anymore.
Yeah.
They're almost unnoticeable.
Yeah. Which is so tiny.
But I still don't think you're going to get rid of that tinnitus by wearing a hearing aid.
Well, you're going to decrease it because you're going to pay attention to the sounds that come into your ear. In other words, you will be able to decrease the tinnitus because you actually can hear people talking better. So my recommendation is, you ought to get your hearing tested. Get it tested at a reliable source. Now, what is a reliable source? You know, because part of the problem is that some hearing aid salespeople mm-hmm. are unscrupulous. And some hearing aid salespeople are really, really good. Yeah. And so, generally I tend towards going to centers which do more than just hearing aids, medical groups, and they're more likely to do a good hearing test. I may not get the hearing aid there, but I'll get the hearing test there because I know then the test will be accurate and tell me whether
or not
the aid's going to
help. Get some junk mail, open it up, and read about a hearing aid and go out and buy that.
Right.
I would go through the medical process, which I did, and it worked out fine. On the tinnitus thing, forget the hearing aids. This may happen with you. I had tinnitus for a number of years, and it just went away.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So, and that's because when you get older, your brain no longer pays attention to things. And one of those things it doesn't pay attention to is
And that's because when you get older, your brain no longer pays attention to
That's very good. That's very good. I like it.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Here's a listener now, Zorba, in St. Charles, Missouri. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes. What's up?
Since I was a small child, I've had leg pains. And as a child, my parents said I would just lay down and cry and scream. But then when I got old enough, I would ask them to rub my legs, or we tried heat, tried cold, none of that worked. The doctors told them it was growing pains. And as time went on, it got less, but it still happens. It happens, I'm 62 now, usually it happens when I've had a hard day, a lot of exercise. And then the minute I lay down, it starts feeling like a really bad headache. Mm. One of my grandchildren has inherited it. She's 3 years old, and she's starting to do the same thing.
Mm.
So I'd like to figure out what it is so that she doesn't have to go through the same thing I did.
This is the whole leg is painful, or the lower leg?
It's from the knee to the ankle.
Knee to the ankle.
Mm-hmm. And it's again, all I can describe it as is a very bad headache. It's an achiness.
And does it feel like it's in the bone or in the
muscle? It does seem
muscle?
Like it helps a lot to do the knee and the ankle when it's being massaged, but it is definitely the muscle as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back of when you were a child, because these tend to be different things. Children often have pains in their legs from a bunch of different reasons. When they're in the growth spurt, they often get it, and we call it growing pains, whatever that is. We call it growing pains, and nobody has ever quite elucidated what actually that consists of. I've got a couple of ideas for you. First of all, I'm not sure what you had as a child. I don't know what that is. You know, there are growing pains, there are growing spurts that occur. I'm not sure what's happening. And what I would recommend that you do for your granddaughter that you're worried about is they diary what's going on. So every day the pain is there. They look back and say, what'd she do today? what she do? Was she out there? Was she exercising? Was she playing with her friends? What did she do? What did she eat? And you keep a diary. And sometimes that's the best way to discover what brings things on. In other words, yeah, every time she goes to the park and she's with that kid and she eats a lot of soda and drinks a lot of junk food, she has these pains. And I would look at it to see if there's a pattern. And if there's a pattern, then I would stop it and see if the pains go away. That's a good way of trying to figure that out. And one of the other things that occurs that often is associated with pains is often they're cramps. So is this a crampy type feeling that you have?
No. Mm-hmm. I've had cramps, swimmer's cramps, things like that. This is not the same thing.
Uh-huh. So it's a sharp,
it's
bright
ache.
Pain? What does it feel like?
Headache in my legs.
A headache in your – now, I have headaches all the time. I'm a headache person. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can't picture a headache in my leg because the headache is only in my brain. I mean, I'm a headache person. I've had migraines since
like
I was
a leg ache sort of. Aren't there stockings that you can wear to?
Well, I've tried that. I'm a nurse, and I'm on my feet quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I've tried that. It doesn't make any difference.
Okay, so often what we can't figure out what's going on, which is your case, is we look towards stretching exercises to see if they will make a difference. And so what I would recommend doing is going to a good physical therapist and say, look, I've got these pains in my legs. I'm not sure what's causing them. What I want to do, this is one route to go, is I want to do good stretching exercises for my calf muscles, soleus muscles, my hamstring muscles, and see whether or not this will change the pain. That'll give you an idea. That's one avenue to go. The other avenue to go is to find a good acupuncturist, because quite often when we can't figure out things such as pain, an acupuncturist can look from their point of view, and they have a different way of looking at pain and medical things, and finding whether or not qi is the energy field that acupuncturists often work with, can be altered to stop the pain. And sometimes 5 or 10 treatments with an acupuncture may stop the pain. So I'd either go the physical therapy route with stretching exercises, or I would go the acupuncture route to find out whether or not this is really – they don't really call them neurological problems. They call them energy problems that basically are going to the wrong part in your spinal cord that are causing the discomfort. So those are the two ways I would look for it. And once again, for your grandchild, what I would do is I would keep a diary to see what's going on.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. A couple of really interesting and difficult questions so far.
Yeah, life is not that simple right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, life is not that simple. So
tinnitus and pain that doesn't go away. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Now, isn't the computer age wonderful? We may be able to take pills that will let us know whether we've forgotten one or sort of chip in the pill.
So first of all, let's look at what the old ways of doing it are. The old ways of doing it are you mark down on a piece of paper whether you took
the
pill.
Right.
That's one way.
Or you don't.
Another way,
in my case.
Or you don't.
You just take a bunch and say, well, I wonder if I've forgotten one.
Yeah. Another low-tech way is to put all your pills in these containers that are daily containers. Monday through Friday and then Saturday and Sunday, and you put them through. And if you go to any drugstore, you can see there are containers that are once-a-day containers that are 3 times a day, 4 times a day. You look in the container and you see, aha, I didn't take my pill. Really simple.
Yeah.
Then there were devices that came out a number of years ago that were alarm devices, and these are devices that basically you set the pill bottle with an alarm cap. It's a special bottle and a cap. And if you don't take your pill at a certain time, it starts to beep, and then the beep gets louder and louder.
Bottle.
If you have an open, doesn't tell that you took the pill. It just tells whether or not. You can fake this out by opening the top and not taking the pill.
Well, yeah, but
most people want to take their pills.
Oh, right. No,
I mean, you know, I'm not looking for this.
But this is another step.
This is a horse of a different color. This is basically something that is put onto the pill. It's a vegetable product that when it comes into contact with stomach acid, basically turns this little product into a battery that signals a waterproof patch that you have on your body that then picks up the data and then sends it when you're within about a certain number of feet from your phone to your phone that tells whether or not you took your pill. And this patch also tells whether or not you've had the right amount of sleep, what your body temperature is, what your heart rate is, and so on. It's
so
a patch.
This will let you know whether you've taken the pill. And if you're near a phone, well, what? Let your doctor
know? It'll not, well, first of all, you know, can you just imagine a doctor going, well, Tom Clark took his pills today.
Well,
how great.
I mean,
who's going to pay attention to that?
If it's near a phone, you
can
say.
A loved one.
Yeah.
A loved one. So for people who are disabled,
I'm sorry. I was thinking caring person. Why did I say doctor?
You know, you better be careful today. You better be careful.
This is amazing stuff.
Well, it's amazing because here it is. These are RFDs, radio frequency devices, which are going to be used in Walmart to make sure whether or not, you know, whether or not something goes out the door that shouldn't go out the door in terms of pilferage and so on. But the concept is you use these RFD devices within pills. The real issue is what you're swallowing that's going to signal the patch on your body that will ultimately go to the phone. What does this thing do to the body? I mean, that would be the thing I would wonder about. What is this sort of little battery does?
Well, you just, I assume, pass it through like you pass.
Well, let me ask you, would you take a pill that could possibly light up and send information to a battery that would be externally to your body and notify Monica, your wife, whether or not you took your pill?
If my doctor told me it was safe, I trust doctors.
Let's go on, move right into the next
800. You don't have to crunch that. I thought that was kind of interesting.
It's a good study, but I crunched it.
800-462-7413. To a listener now in Quincy, Illinois. Hello.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate that call. How can we help?
I'm 57 years old, and approximately 2 years ago, I started getting gout attacks. It started in my foot, and now I get it in my elbow, my fingers, my knees, my ankles.
Ooh.
I travel a lot, so I've seen a lot of different doctors at ambulatory care centers.
Mm-hmm.
And what seems to work best for me is prednisone.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what your opinion would be on that, doctor.
Uh-huh. Well, first,
I don't take it very often. I only take it when I have the bouts, and it seems to get rid of it.
So you're getting your care from 10,000 different doctors at 10,000 different locations. I mean, you know, you've got the McDonald's concept of medical care. And you take prednisone. There's several drugs that can be used for the attacks. One is called colchicine. It's an old drug, very useful. Anti-inflammatory drugs work quite well. Two over-the-counter Aleve tablets, literally 2 to 3 times a day for 3 or 4 days will often break an attack. Indocin is sort of a drug that's used for gout attacks that's common. And then, you know, as you said, prednisone is used. It can have some side effects, so we like to stay away from prednisone. But the real issue is that there are drugs to prevent you from getting the gout attacks. Have any of the doctors talked to you about those drugs?
Now, the only one I've tried colchicine, and that really makes me ill.
Uh-huh.
Now, they've mentioned allopurinol.
Right. Uh-huh.
I haven't taken any of that yet because I don't know if I've heard it could bring on attacks of gout.
Well, you bring up a really good point. What happens with allopurinol? There are two drugs on the market. Allopurinol is an older drug. It's been on the market for 40 years. Works 80% of the time, probably 70% of the time. And then a new drug called Uloric. Uloric has been on the market for a little bit less than a year. It's you use it for people whose kidneys are not working as well and for people who fail on allopurinol. Allopurinol basically stops the production of uric acid. When you get gout, either you're an overproducer or an under-excreter. And in any case, if we stop the uric acid from being produced, we decrease the amount of gout. But for the first 6 months you're on the uric acid-lowering drugs, you tend to get attacks. And the way you keep the attacks from happening is you take one Aleve tablet twice a day. And if that doesn't work, you take two Aleve tablets twice a day for 6 months. And basically, you do that for the first 6 months so you keep from getting attacks. And allopurinol may keep you from getting any attacks, may drop them to zero. I mean, I have a lot of patients who have been on allopurinol for, I don't know, 20 years, 25 years, and they get an attack once every 3 to 5 years versus once every couple of months.
Well,
so you
now, are there any side effects to allopurinol?
It's a well tolerated drug. I mean, there are, you know, if you look at the printout, and most people do not have any side effects. You know, the side effects that you have are A, recurrent gout attacks, which are awful, and B, you're taking prednisone, and prednisone is not a great drug to take, and it's okay to take occasionally, but you want to keep the attacks from happening. So You need a family doc of some sort that you see. They do take a uric acid level when you're not having an attack, because it'll be artificially low during an attack. And you start on allopurinol, and you take the prophylaxis from an Aleve tablet one or two twice a day, and you stay on that for 6 months, and then you stop, and your attacks may disappear. That's what you need.
Well, okay. Thank you very much. How about diet?
Diet is a minimal problem, but if you want to pay attention to diet, there is a culprit in diet that's very interesting, and it's high fructose corn syrup. People who drink a lot of soda pop have more gout, and it has nothing to do with their weight. People who are overweight have more gout, but people who drink more soda pop. So I've got a question for you. Guess what the number one state in the union is for gout?
Might it be Alabama?
No, but you got the A word, right? It's Alaska. Alaska is number one, and Wisconsin is number two, and it's probably because of the consumption of beer, which also is associated with gout. So,
yeah, and I do drink beer, and I drink import. I tend to drink the stronger imported beers than the domestic beer.
Yeah, so that has a factor, too. I would recommend allopurinol. Find yourself a good primary care doc and go to them.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doctor. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. And before the break, Zorba, let's pause for another Judge Zorba case. The prosecutor in today's case of the five-hour energy pill is Stephanie from Jacksonville, Florida. Stephanie is the prosecutor. Her husband is the defendant. And I've got to tell you, looking over this case, I don't know how it made it to the Judge Zorba court. This one should have been settled out of court. It's so obvious. Who's going to win this one? Let me continue. My husband is 53 years old, and he drinks one of those five-hour energy drinks every day around noon. If he does not take them, he has no energy. He cannot make it through the day and can barely keep his eyes open. He does not exercise at night because he does not have the energy by the time he comes home. He used to exercise regularly. I say it is the energy shots, that they are counteractive and they suck the life out of him and he needs to get off of them. He insists that he has to have them. Who is right?
She is right.
Why am I not surprised?
She is right. It's so obvious. It does suck the energy out of him, and that sucks his life away. Here it is. He comes home. He's just washed out from this over-caffeinated life. Can hardly even exercise, let alone even talk to his wife or be with his wife. Yeah. He may not even have time to share intimacy at night because of these silly five-hour energy drinks. Take those five-hour energy drinks and toss them in the garbage.
And maybe get a treadmill.
Get a life.
If you can't settle your case out of court and you want Judge Zorba to rule on it, send your affidavit or email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. You know, we have lots more of your calls. We have some interesting topics to talk over. Our medical Mythbuster. Oh, and next, our recipe here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Do you have a question for Zorba? Well, we still have time to hear your call. We have callers waiting, but an open line for you at 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Now, though, Zorba, recipe time. This one for beer steamed salmon.
That's right. Beer steamed salmon. Do you like salmon?
I do.
Yeah. How about a good beer?
I have a beer on occasion.
Yeah, I have a beer on occasion. How about steam?
Yeah, take it or leave it.
But actually, it's a good variation. Salmon is my favorite fish. I mean, if I had to pick one fish, I would pick salmon. I like it because it has omega-3 fatty acids. It's good. The taste is fantastic. I like fresh salmon better than frozen salmon. But frozen salmon, you can get a very good taste out of it because of the oil that absorbs flavor. And it's the good oil. There's really good oil and bad oil that we can eat. And it's a versatile versatile dish, and this is a good example of the versatility of salmon, what you can do with it.
I like salmon. My favorite fish is blackened catfish. But other than that, salmon, I think, is nice.
Blackened catfish is pretty good.
Goody stuff.
I like that.
Okay, let's do this one.
So we're going to use some turkey bacon. Start out with 2 to 3 slices of turkey bacon sliced into bits.
We have this one, by the way, to taste after we do the recipe.
My mouth is watering.
2 to 3 slices of turkey bacon sliced into bits.
That's right, little bits. And we're going to use turkey bacon because we're going to make it more heart healthy.
Yeah.
Once again, our goal is always to figure out what can we do in small ways to make a difference in our diet. And it's my belief now that people go, especially, you know, during certain times of the year after birthdays, New Year's, any time of the year, you know, that's a special event, they'll say, well, I'm really going to go on a diet. I'm going to make some major changes in my life. Mm-hmm. And then 2 days later after they make the major changes, they are back to where they started. I mean, New Year's resolutions, studies have shown, last about a day, minimally.
Right.
But it's my belief that small changes in your diet can result in big changes overall. So instead of looking at something massive, it's how can I change one thing? This is a good example. 2 to 3 slices of turkey bacon versus regular bacon is going to save you maybe 30 to 50 calories in fat. And it's going to be a better fat because it's going to be from the turkey.
But you have to make a number of small changes, not just one a month or something.
But it's these small changes that make a difference. A number of small changes add up to things, just like, you know, spend a little money here, spend a little money there. I don't know about you, but when I look at my Visa bill or my MasterCard bill, most of my bill comes from small purchases, not from big purchases. And most of our extra calories and our wrong calories come from small things that we do. All these small things add up. A small red onion diced.
A small red onion diced.
Now ask me why we use red onion.
Why do we use red onion?
Thank you. Thank you for asking.
That's all right.
For beauty.
Yeah.
For beauty.
Yeah.
You know, for the way it looks. Yeah. You could use any onion, but red onion looks good.
Okay.
Some pepper.
Pepper.
To taste. A tablespoonful of butter.
Big T butter.
Yeah. And I've gotten back to using butter instead of always using margarine. And it tastes better used in small amounts. It's just fine. And we know now that when we get butter that's in a stick, that we run into trans fats that basically are the same as butter. So why not go for the gold, which is butter. 4 ounces of wheat beer.
4 ounces of has to be wheat beer.
Yeah, it could really be any beer, but if you use light beer here, it wouldn't taste very much at all. You want to have a beer that has a little bit of heft to it, and a wheat beer would be a good example. If you want more heft, you could probably use stout. You could probably use 4 ounces of Guinness, but that might taste a little bitter. But, you know, if you like stout, you might try that. 8 ounce salmon fillet.
8 ounce salmon fillet.
And salt to taste. Okay. In a sauté pan, brown the bacon and onions, okay? And then season with pepper. Just before the bacon is browned, add the butter. Now, pour the beer into the pan, and just before it boils, reduce it to a simmer. So you're reducing it to a simmer. Then add the salmon, skin side down, and season the salmon now with salt, and then cover it. Very important to cover it. And let the salmon fillet cook for about 3 minutes, or until it's firm. That'll be about 3 minutes. Take the cover off, flip it, and cook for another 3 minutes. Again, make sure that cover is on. Very important, because it's going to steam all those juices into the salmon. Then remove the cover and the salmon from the pan. Let the sauce reduce by half. So the salmon is on a plate. You're taking the sauce, reducing it by half the volume, then place the salmon on that nice dish that you have and pour the reduced sauce over it and enjoy it. It is delicious. And you know what? Now we get to taste it. So you try it initially.
It's right.
It looks
a little weird, but it smells good.
Well, that's because it wasn't produced 10 minutes ago. Let's see how it tastes. What do you think about it?
Adam gave it to us cold, which was okay with, this is tasty.
See, you can tell. Tom is immediately, his eyes are watering. He just loves the taste of it. 261 calories, 19% of the fat you need for the day, but it's good fat. It's not bad fat. It's got very little sugar of it, and 52% of the protein you need for the entire day. I'm going to try this myself, and it tastes
Mmm. Isn't that good? Yeah.
This is, you know what? It's fabulous cold.
Well, don't seem so surprised. Okay, now there's probably a way our listeners can get this recipe.
Absolutely. I know you'll be shocked. But on the World Wide Web, if you come to our website, at ZorbaPastor.org.
First you find a computer, right?
First you got to find that computer. That's right.
All right.
Then you've got to learn how to turn it on. That's right. Then you've got to go with whatever the operating system is, Windows or that other system called Apple. And then if you do that, you go to ZorbaPastor.org. You can find this recipe, all of a number of our others, very good recipes, and you can sign up for our weekly podcast. And you do that at ZorbaPastor.org.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. Let's see now, Zorba, if we can help a listener in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
I have a brother who's 47 years old who is a diabetic and has been a diabetic for 10 years. He has taken insulin and now he's on another drug, but I really don't know what it is. I get really, really, really mixed messages about the use of alcohol for diabetics. Some say it's okay, some say it's not, and I really am confused. If you could help me out a little bit with that, I would really appreciate it. And then I have some other questions if we have time.
Sure. How much does he drink?
How much does he say he drinks, or how much have I observed that he drinks?
Well,
he drinks, I would say, a half a bottle of wine, sometimes vodka, sometimes tequila, sometimes beer, but he drinks every day.
Every day, a half a bottle of wine or something?
Close.
Mm-hmm. And when he drinks spirits, does he drink half a bottle of vodka?
Oh, no. He'll have a shot or two
of that.
But I have seen him under the influence many times when he really doesn't own up to it.
Just out of curiosity, how much does he say he drinks?
Not very much. Within the allowed amount, according to his physician.
Within the allowed amount, according to his physician. I love
it. Is that the vaguest thing you've ever heard?
That's it. That's as vague as, you can be. Do you drink two drinks a day? Yes, I drink two drinks a day. Do you drink more than two drinks a day? Well, you didn't ask me that question, did you? You know, that's basically what it is. Alcohol is really a carbohydrate, and that's what it is. So it's like other carbohydrates. You know, it's part of your dietary plan. It counts. It has calories. And so, you know, when you have calories, basically the food goes into your body and the sugar is in your bloodstream. And you need either insulin or other medication to get the food out of the bloodstream into the muscles. And that's basically what we do with diabetes. We've got, you know, this food source in our pipes and we don't have it in our muscles and in our brain where we really need it. So, I mean, it's part of his calories. And basically, one of the issues with diabetics is that they're at risk for heart disease and stroke. And because of that, we recommend that for female diabetics, they limit themselves to a drink and a half a day. And for men, it's two drinks or less. So if he's drinking more than two drinks, it's not good for his diabetes, but it's bad for his heart, his risk of a heart attack and stroke. Now, if you recommend that your brother drink less, what is he going to say to you?
None of your business.
I don't
drink that much.
Uh-huh, none of your business. So this is your baby brother or your older brother?
It's my older brother.
He's your older brother. And you've been talking to him about things like this for years, right?
For years, a lot of health issues that I really have no answers for.
Uh-huh. But actually, you've got some great answers. The reality is it sounds like he does not take care of himself. One of the major causes of amputations in this country is because of diabetics who have foot problems and they're not paying attention to their diabetes the way that they should. So my recommendation to you is tell your brother he's drinking too much. It may help. But you never know. You never know when all of a sudden people see the light and make a change. And so I think that's a good step.
It's so interrelated that it's totally scary.
It's very scary. Good luck to you, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for enlightening me. Thanks.
And good luck from me, too. 800-462-7413. Let's jump over to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox now, Zorba, and grab a quick tip from a listener in Florida. This helpful hint deals with eye twitching, which we were chatting about recently. The listener writes, I heard the caller who wanted help with eye twitching and have a suggestion for her. I, too, have this problem occasionally, and a good friend of mine told me to try tonic water. I don't know if it's the quinine in the tonic water or what, but I know it really does work. When my eye starts twitching, I drink even half of a bottle, and the twitching goes away. I do not add any alcohol and don't know if it would work that way, but tonic water is the answer.
I think when she said she didn't add alcohol, she means I'm not having a gin and tonic.
Yeah.
I'm just having a tonic tonic. Well, quinine is an old remedy which has been used for hundreds of years to stop twitching and leg cramps and so on. Quinine tablets were basically taken off the market by the feds because they said there was no proven efficacy. And a number of people now get their quinine from Canada because they swear that it really works for them. My recommendation is if the shoe fits, wear it. Yeah. If the quinine order stops the twitchy eye, it's a great folk remedy that does you no harm and may be quite nice. And if you want to mix it with a little gin and it's the evening time, that might be okay too.
Hey, if it's summer and if it's noontime, it might be okay. You don't have to wait till 5 o'clock to have a gin and tonic in the nice, warm weather. Okay, send the emails if you want. Have a home remedy you want to share? We want to hear it. Send your tips to us in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. That's Zorba@WPR.org.
An interesting topic to talk over. Some interesting calls, we hope, from you at 800-462-7413, and our medical mythbuster, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Remember that toll-free number, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, you mentioned some information on weight loss surgery and the heart.
Right. Now, when you think of weight loss surgery, gastric bypass, the gastric pouch, the Roux-en-Y procedure, these are all procedures to basically help people lose weight, especially people who are morbidly obese. What do you think about? I mean, think about vanity, right?
Yeah, I want to be thinner. You do think about it.
Not always. And with the morbidly obese, it's not just vanity. It's the ability to be able to walk upstairs.
Sure.
It's able to sit in an airplane seat.
Mm-hmm.
The other month, I was on an airplane, and this guy sat next to me, and he must have clocked in at about 400 pounds. Yeah. I felt bad for him. I also felt bad for me because he was crowding over into my seat. It's a big issue. And the question has been, what does this do for your heart? Now, the data has shown that for some people who are morbidly obese, they actually stop being a diabetic because their weight comes down, they're able to exercise. But the question is, what is actually going on with the heart? For years, we've known that obesity and heart disease are connected. But this is a good article, came out of the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, very prestigious journal, looked at 400 severely obese patients. These are patients who are really obese. They've got a BMI of a minimum of 48. That's really, I mean, the BMI is a measurement of obesity.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was they found they had smaller waistlines at the end. They lost 100 pounds on average. That's a lot of weight.
Yep.
Lower blood pressure. Their heart rate was better. Their cholesterol was better. Their insulin resistance was better. But most importantly, it appeared that their heart mass size had actually changed. Their heart had actually remodeled.
Because you always think if a person is really obese that it's bad for the heart. But you're saying the heart actually changes?
It changes when the obesity came down. Now, remodeling is very interesting. We think of our heart as being static. You know, our bodies are static, our muscles are static, but it's not the case. It turns out there's certain drugs, such as drugs called ACE inhibitors that are useful for blood pressure, mm-hmm. that appear to cause a remodeling. And the issue has been, what does this remodeling mean? Well, when the heart gets maybe too big, it might get too floppy, if you will, and doesn't do a good job. When the body gets smaller, the heart may become toned up. Mm. That's probably the best way to say it, toned up, almost like a six-pack ab of your heart. But this remodeling is very, very interesting because it may ultimately lead to less heart disease, less heart failure, and longevity.
Well, I was just going to ask, do we have evidence that when you lose weight, if you're obese and lose weight, that you're less likely to have heart problems?
Well, we have good evidence that when people return to a normal weight, they have less heart disease. There's good evidence for that, but we don't know why. And this particular study shows that it may be a remodeling that occurs. And I think this also really means that people who are morbidly obese, who are debating whether or not to have bypass surgery, this is another thing to have. Gastric bypass surgery may help your heart.
800-462-7413, and a listener now, Zorba, in Middleton, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. I have a question about prolonged use of over-the-counter nasal sprays. At different times of the year, I will have just swelling in my nasal passages that constrict my breathing, and I've tried antihistamines and decongestants, and they don't seem to help those times when they come, especially in the evening when I go to bed. And what I do is I just take just a very, very small shot of the over-counter nasal sprays, and I may have to use it for a week or more. One of the side effects, if I don't do it, is a very painful jab in my side of my ribs from snoring from my wife. So there's that trade-off I'm trying to deal with. But the question is it a problem using just very small amount once a day with those over-the-counter nasal sprays, or is there something else I should be looking at?
Well, there definitely is something else you should be looking at. The over-the-counter sprays tend to be addictive for people, and they'll use them often for 2 or 3 days, and then all of a sudden they have to use them every day, or they develop there's a big scientific phrase which basically means that you've over-medicated your nose, and so the sinuses now are beginning to respond, and the nasal turbinates, these little swellings in your nose, are beginning to respond to a lack of nose spray.
He's just using a little bit.
Doesn't matter. A little bit, big bit. If you have to use it every day, it's not great for your nose. And there are better things that you can use for that. You're right. The over-the-counter decongestants like Sudafed only work so much. But my recommendation for this is you're much better off either with an antihistamine nasal spray or a steroid nasal spray. And the way you get to that is basically you take the over-the-counter nasal spray and you get it out of the house. Physically, you have to get it out of the house because you will use it at night. So you've got to toss it, put it in the garbage, get out of the house, have your wife take the car keys, and don't let you go out. But seriously, if it's in the house during the night, your nose is going to swell up and you're going to respond to it and just take it. And call your doctor and get a steroid nasal spray. That's really the best stuff. And start on that a day or two before you stop the over-the-counter spray.
Okay.
All right. And that's how you get rid of it. And then the steroid nasal spray is much, much safer. And the high dose for that are generally 2 squirts twice a day. Do that until you get over the swelling. And then go down to probably just 1 squirt at bedtime. And I bet you that'll work. That works 9 out of 10 times. And if not, you add an antihistamine nasal spray. And again, these are prescription nasal sprays, and they really, really work. But the over-the-counter sprays, get rid of it, toss it. It's not good for your nose.
Good. And it sounds like it also take care of the sharp pains in my ribs too.
It might. The sharp pains in your ribs.
From the missus. Thanks
got
so
it.
Much. Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Yeah. I, a few years ago, you may remember, got hooked on one of those over-the-counter. I've never been so sick in my life trying to get off of that.
It's very hard.
Getting off
it's
of that. Hard. Oh,
very
it was hard. Awful.
Yeah, it's awful.
They should
yeah.
take those things
yeah.
off the market.
Yeah, they should take them off the market, but they won't take them off the market.
There should be a 12-step way of...
12-step program for getting rid of nasal spray. I love it. It won't just be AA or Narcotics Anonymous or Overeaters Anonymous. It'll now be Nasal Spray Users Anonymous. I got it, Tom.
Let's get to our medical myth buster now, Zorba. Today's myth deals with veggies. We've talked quite a bit on this show about how cooking vegetables reduces their nutrients. But what about cooling them? Can you preserve a vegetable's nutrients by storing in the fridge?
Well, first of all, you can preserve a vegetable's nutrients by freezing it. Freezing is a very effective way. It may not taste as good, but it's a very effective way of preserving the nutrients. Refrigeration definitely slows down the deterioration of vitamins, not mm-hmm. minerals. Minerals are inorganic, so they don't deteriorate, but vitamins do. And the longer the fresh produce is on the shelf in the grocery store, the more it loses nutrients. When you take something, we'll say, such as green beans, as a perfect example, it's flash frozen. And quite often, frozen green beans will have 50% more vitamins in it than fresh green beans. So, you know, the answer, of course, is whenever you can to buy locally. But, I mean, you know, I live in Wisconsin, and if I had to buy my local produce in the middle of the winter, you know, my produce would be snow. Yeah. I mean, that would be about all I could eat. I mean, there's no local produce that's actually produced. So refrigeration slows down the deterioration. Freezing does an even better job. The more local the produce, the fresher the produce, the better off we are.
And if you're buying veggies and not going to eat them that day, you should throw them in the fridge.
Yeah. Oh, definitely throw them in the fridge. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. Which is, but a vegetable that's been in the refrigerator for a week is not going to be as nutritious as a vegetable that you may have frozen. On the other hand, eating more fruits and veggies has lots of other benefits, including the phytochemicals and the minerals that are there also. So it's very important to eat your veggies.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust? Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Moving right along to the phones we go. Knoxville, Tennessee with us now. Hello.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
How can we help?
Well, I have a torn meniscus. I've been diagnosed. This was about a year ago. Earlier in the decade, I used to run marathons. I ran four between like 2001 and 2003, I think. Mm. And the question I have is, when he diagnosed me last year, he wanted to do, I guess, the arthroscopic surgery. And I put it off, and then I ran into a friend. He's from Ghana. He plays playing soccer. He tore his meniscus, and he actually had it repaired. And I thought, are you sure it's your meniscus? And I'm like, why did my doctor give me that option? Well, so I went back to him last month, and I mentioned this, and he said, well, you know, at your age, we're not sure if we can repair it, but, you know, we'll do the surgery. If I can repair it, I will. If not, I'll take it out or whatever. So I felt better about that than just him taking it out. But I guess my question to you is, like, what do you think of that diagnosis? Should I try other options, you know, or, I mean, do I have it?
Well, first of all, the meniscus itself never heals. So the concept of repair is rather interesting. Repair usually means they snip around the meniscus and they remove a small amount of it. And, you know, we used to say, well, just remove the whole meniscus. That's many, many years ago. Now we know we remove the amount of a meniscus that is necessary to achieve the state. And sometimes you have to go back and forth and remove the meniscus a couple of times in little spots. But the meniscus itself doesn't actually heal. And that's the whole problem. And we have no artificial meniscus to put in there that hasn't been invented yet. Lots of research and nothing really has come out for it. So I'm not sure what your buddy had in terms of it. I mean, he may have had a little repair, might have been a stitch that was put in there, but basically it doesn't actually heal and doesn't actually produce the healing that you want. The issue is, if you've got a meniscus problem and your leg swells and you've got pain and you have discomfort, you want to get rid of that part of the meniscus that's causing the problem. That's the bottom line. And what you want to do is, if you're happy with the doc that you're going to, the orthopedic surgeon, use that one or use another one. You know, I'm very keen on a second opinion. Do you like the guy you went to?
Well, yeah. Well, I work at a local university, and he speaks a lot of the athletes, and you go in the doctor's office, and he's got the pictures all up over there, and they're autographing and thanking him for saving their careers and whatnot.
But you know what? That's a good recommendation. I mean, you know, sometimes it's a little flashy. You walk into the office, and you know, you've got pictures from, you know, from famous people or locally famous people. On the other hand, these are athletes. They've gone. They want to have minimal. They want the minimal that can be done in order to preserve function. You're an athlete. You've run a number of marathons. You said your marathon days are over. I wouldn't be so sure. Your marathon days might not be over. You might still be able to run marathons, what you need to do is get that knee fixed so that you can enter the sport that you want to enter. And even though it might not be a marathon, it might be a half marathon or it might be a walking marathon, the idea is for you to be able to get up and do something, and that's critical. And it sounds to me like you need surgery. Sounds like you're pleased with the person you went to. I think I would go get it fixed.
Okay, great.
Thanks so much for your call.
Almost out of time now, Zorba, but before we leave for the week, we have a note here from a freshly minted deputy of the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police. This comes from Deputy Lisa out of the Rogersville, Tennessee Bureau of the Grammar Police. but you might only be the accomplice in this citation, Zorba. Lisa is taking her fellow Tennessean to task. Not too long ago, we had a caller on the show from Knoxville, Tennessee, who pronounced APPALACHIAN, like in that word trail, wrong, according to Deputy Lisa. She writes, "It was easy to tell the caller from Knoxville was not a native Tennessean, and he committed a grievous error, which Zorba repeated. Appalachian is not pronounced with a long A. The correct pronunciation is Appalachia or Appalachian. Almost everyone north of the Mason-Dixon line makes this mistake, and it is a sore point with the natives."
I can understand that.
I always have said Appalachia.
Yeah, I've said Appalachia too, but I understand that because I'm from Chicago. And everyone in Chicago calls it Chicago, and people outside Chicago call it Chicago.
A lot do, that's right.
Absolutely. So I can immediately tell if somebody is not from Chicago because they say Chicago.
Appalachian, I don't think I've ever said Appalachian.
No, well, but that's because you're from nowhere.
I'm from the north of the Mason.
And you're not from anywhere in particular.
I am, too.
You lived all over the country.
Here's what I'm from, and this one has gotten wrong by everybody else in the world. I'm from Milwaukee. And proud of it. I'm a Milwaukeean. If you'd like to join the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar, please, even if Zorba isn't the main culprit, send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Take care, Tom, and stay well.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Ferris Bueller Friedrich produced this hour with the help from our technical director, Brad Cameron Fry Kohlberg. Our executive producer is that same Friedrich guy, and our theme music is by Leon Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting you to be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0219Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.